Hi, I'm Paul DiRienzo, host of a new program on WBAI, the Thursday edition of Trump Watch, the first 100 days. On Trump Watch, we dissect and inspect the administration of President Donald J. Trump, searching for meaning in the chaos. Tune in every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. following the evening news. Listen while you still can.
Hi, this is Barbara Glickstein. Diana Mason and I co-host Health Styles. Here's my ask. Please become a BAI buddy. It's only 33 cents a day, and that math equals $10 a month, and you're going to be supporting your station. Why don't you become one of us? Become that activist global citizen making a difference in the world every day, and just for 33 cents. We've been around for quite a while here at WBAI, and we think this is an awesome new idea. So please join us and become a BAI buddy. Go to WBAI.org and sign up. And thank you.
Hello and welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Bob Letter and Catherine Davis. In the first half of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at the push for universal healthcare here in New York and a piece of legislation that would do that for a fully public program and a whole campaign built around it. So stay tuned for that, and Catherine Davis will be here during the second half of the program. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. President Trump has directed several federal agencies to institute new work requirements for people on Medicaid, food stamps, rent subsidies, and other social programs. In an executive order signed last week, President directed the Departments of Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Agriculture, and other agencies to make a top-to-bottom review of their social safety net programs with the goal of finding ways to push more people off the programs and into work. With Republicans in control of the White House and Congress, conservatives have pushed the Trump administration to take advantage of a rare opportunity to unwind or overhaul a variety of public assistance programs, which they say promotes dependency and are easy to exploit. However, the effort in works for months had stalled amid an internal debate in the White House and ultimately took a backseat to infrastructure spending as a top legislative priority in Congress, leaving conservatives now with only an executive order. The federal government spent more than $700 billion on welfare to low-income welfare programs for low-income households in 2017. Food stamps, which are used by about 43 million U.S. residents, and a cash benefit known as temporary assistance for needy families, which helps about 3.5 million people, are among the program President Trump wants to target, along with Medicaid and various housing programs. The executive order follows policy shifts already underway at several agencies. Under President Trump, Health and Human Services has already sought to enshrine work requirements for Medicaid, a first in the history of this health care program for the poor. The states of Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas got the green light earlier this year to require certain able-bodied adults to work as a condition of receiving their health benefits. Advocates for the poor contend that employment rules for Medicaid are not legal and have already sued states to stop requirements from taking effect. Conservatives are now using the president's new executive order to push federal health agencies to approve similar pending Medicaid work requirement requests in other states, including Utah, Maine, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Alabama. While politically liberal social welfare groups digested the Trump's new executive order and voiced concerns and objections about it, conservative groups immediately released statements hailing it. In a written statement, President Trump said that his order would, quote, restore independence and dignity to millions of Americans, close quote. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports that opioid distributors will face tough questions from lawmakers next month about their role in the nation's ongoing addiction crisis. Five executives of opioid distribution companies will testify before the House Energy and Commerce Committee in early May about how millions of opioid-based pain pills found their way to small West Virginia towns. Representatives from McKesson Corporation, Cardinal Health Incorporated, AmerisourceBergen Corporation, Miami Lucan Incorporated, and H.D. Smith Wholesale Drug Company will testify at the hearing. For the past year, both Republicans and Democrats on the committee have pressed these five distributors, as well as the Drug Enforcement Agency, for answers as to how tremendous amounts of pills ended up in these small communities. One firm sent 4 million pain pills to a town of 1,400 people from 2008 to 2015. The hearing comes as Congress steps up action on the opioid crisis. Both the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Senate Health Committee both hope to pass forward legislation addressing the epidemic sometime this spring. The Senate Finance Committee has also announced it would hold a hearing this week on how to improve Medicare and Medicaid's response to the opioid epidemic. In a related story, The Hill also reports that a federal judge in Ohio has set a trial date for a part of a massive combined lawsuit against drug manufacturers and distributors over the opioid epidemic. Judge Dan Polster last week set a March 2019 trial date for cases from three of the many cities and counties that are suing these drug companies. Those cases would be the first in hundreds brought under the judge's review to seek a trial and could serve as bellwethers that help sides test the waters. The cases are being closely watched to see if they produce a settlement that forces changes meant to fight the opioid epidemic. Judge Polster said in January that he wanted to take actions that would stem the tide of the crisis and said last week that while he wants a settlement, the companies have asserted that they cannot reach a final settlement without litigating certain related matters, and so scheduling a trial will likely help address these impediments. And finally, The Hill also reports that two senators, one Republican and one Democrat, are calling on U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to cease efforts by the Drug Enforcement Agency to slow medical marijuana research. In a letter sent last week, Senators Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, and Kamala Harris, Democrat of California, said they are concerned by reports that the Justice Department is effectively blocking the agency from taking action on more than two dozen requests to grow marijuana for use in medical research. The senator's letter states, quote, "Research on marijuana is necessary for evidence-based decision-making, and expanded research has been called for by President Trump's Attorney General, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Highway Safety Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, the National Academies of Sciences, and the National Institute on Drug Abuse." Attorney General, close quote. Attorney General Sessions has been an outspoken opponent of marijuana throughout most of his career and frequently speaks harshly about its use. Sessions has also signaled that he's skeptical about the medical benefits of smoking marijuana. The Drug Enforcement Agency has maintained marijuana's classification as a Schedule I controlled substance, which means it effectively has no accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. However, the agency has been open to medical research regarding marijuana and changed its policy 2 years ago to allow for more suppliers because of growing interest in researching more medicinal uses of the drug. To date, only one manufacturer, the University of Mississippi, is licensed to produce marijuana for federally sanctioned medical research. According to Senators Hatch and Harris, at least 25 manufacturers have formally applied to produce federally approved research-grade marijuana. However, the agency has not approved those requests, and the senators say they are concerned the Justice Department has been sitting on the applications. The senators asked Attorney General Sessions for a commitment that the agency would resolve all outstanding applications by this summer at the latest, exactly 2 years since the agency announced its policy change. 38 states and the District of Columbia have legalized marijuana in some form. 8 states in the District of Columbia allow recreational use of the drug. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment in a moment, taking a look at the push for universal health care legislation here in New York. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment in this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at the push for universal health care here in New York State. There's been a bill in the legislature for a number of years now, and a campaign sprung up about it, and it is legislative season that we're in right now. Joining us to give us an update and help people understand how they can get involved, we welcome back Katie Robbins, who's the executive director of the Campaign for New York Health, and Ursula Rosam, who's an upstate coordinator with the campaign. Welcome to Health Action, Katie and Ursula.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Katie, let's start out with you a little bit. This is a campaign built around a piece of legislation known as the New York Health Act. Can you briefly summarize the bill for listeners?
Absolutely. So the New York Health Act would create a universal public health care system. Sometimes this is referred to as a single-payer system. And essentially, it would cover every resident with high-quality, comprehensive health insurance, making sure that everybody has access to care. And the interesting thing about this proposal is that we don't have to spend a penny more than we currently do on health care. Moving to a universal public system, as described in the New York Health Act, would bring tremendous savings to New York, actually. There was an economic impact study done in 2015 showing that on the state level, by streamlining administration, allowing bargaining power to buy pharmaceuticals and medical equipment, we could save $45 billion, about 15% of healthcare costs on the state level. But also, it would move to a progressive financing system so that individuals like you and me would pay less as well. The study estimated 98% of New Yorkers would spend less on healthcare, but actually get better coverage, comparable to what other countries have, you know, that where they spend less, they get more and have much better health outcomes than we do here in New York State and in the country.
And Ursula, now turning to you, can you give us a little bit of just an overview of the campaign that has sprung up in support of this legislation?
So yeah, the campaign has been growing really steadily over the last few years, and we have grassroots organizers and volunteers advocating in support of the New York Health Act around the state. And one of the things that we've been doing around the state is asking people to share their healthcare stories, because we know anecdotally that costs is a major barrier to health care that families face. And what we're doing is a statewide survey where just regular New York Health Act supporters are going out and asking their friends and neighbors to answer questions about health care and to really share those stories publicly via letters to the editor with their state senators and assembly members to really make the case that everyone needs health care and that too many people are facing barriers to getting care. But, around the state the past 3 years, we've really seen support steadily growing. So we're really, you know, we're really close to having New York be the first state to potentially pass a universal health care bill.
Katie, there are different key constituencies that have come together in the Campaign for New York Health. Can you tell us who some of those folks are?
Sure. So primarily, the Campaign for New York Health was pulled together by organizations that represent nurses, the New York State Nurses Association, also physicians through Physicians for a National Health Program's New York chapter. In addition, statewide Senior Action has been a longtime supporter, so seniors are with us on this issue. In addition to our growing coalition, we have more and more groups signing on. For example, the New York chapter of NASW, the social workers, is now a strong endorser. We recently had the New York Organic Farming Association endorsed. So we have farmers who are advocating for the New York Health Act. So it's really growing. And we also have a campaign that has been approaching businesses, and we have over 300 businesses in New York State that have endorsed this proposal. So it's really a growing and very broad and diverse group of advocates that are behind it, from providers to patients to people who are trying to provide care to themselves and their employees in the system.
Now, the New York Health Act is a bill that's been kicking around for quite a while in the legislature. Can you give us a little background on sort of where things stand in the legislative process?
Yeah, so this bill has been around for a while. I think it was first introduced in 1993, and it did actually pass the Assembly in the 90s for the first time. But because of our coalition that really came together with a more concerted effort in 2014, we established the Campaign for New York Health as a C4 and had very targeted advocacy around the bill. We've seen a tremendous increase in public support, and that has translated to some legislative movement. The bill has passed the Assembly 3 years in a row. It should pass again this year in 2018 for the fourth year in a row. And in the Senate, we need 32 votes to pass the bill. At the end of last session, we actually had 31 co-sponsors. But as you know, Mark, we haven't been able to break through the partisan divide on this issue. So unfortunately, we don't have any Republican co-sponsors on the bill in the Senate or the Assembly. And so with the current Republican-controlled Senate, there has not been any movement in committees or a floor vote yet. But as we are all keeping our eyes on the special election on April 24th and the shakeup in the Senate, depending on what Senator Felder decides to do, we may see leadership flip as soon as this spring.
And Ursula, one of the things that I know you and folks upstate have been involved with is approaching local governments for supportive resolutions of this to their state legislative colleagues. Can you tell us a little bit about that initiative?
The local resolutions are a really powerful way for local folks and local governments to let their state legislators know about the need for universal health care, and also Katie mentioned earlier the savings that universal public health care would give to New Yorkers would also translate to municipalities, because some of the highest costs on municipal budgets are health care costs, whether it's a school board or a county. And so we've seen at least 12 legislative bodies pass resolutions in support of the bill. I believe the most recent one was the town of Cheektowaga in Erie County, but they're also the city of Buffalo has passed a resolution. Rockland County and Sullivan County have passed resolutions. And these all happened because local advocates approached their legislators and just explained the bill to them, and really worked with those local legislators to pass resolutions. And I know that your listeners might be largely in New York City, and I'll add that the Manhattan Community Board 12 is also one of the municipal bodies that has passed a resolution in support of the New York Health Act. So this is literally something that anyone anywhere in the state can do, is approach their town council, their community board, and educate them about the benefits of the New York Health Act.
And there is an effort underway here in the city council in New York City. Katie, you want to tell us what's been going on with that?
Well, we do have a very supportive council. Cory Johnson as the new speaker, who has said he's interested in pursuing single payer on the municipal level. And we're hoping that we can inspire council members to actually put through a resolution supporting the New York Health Act and Medicare for All on the national level. So we'll be keeping people posted on how they can participate in supporting that campaign. But these local resolutions are great in addition, because we do see a break in the partisan divide on the issue. In Rockland County and in Sullivan County, Republicans have voted in favor of resolutions supporting single payer at those levels. So we think that's a really positive sign for the movement.
It is an election year this year. We'll be electing our next governor and state legislature. How is this bill and campaign dealing with all of that? What's the plan?
Well, it is an exciting time, an exciting year. We, for the first time, are seeing candidates running explicitly on the New York Health Act. Our campaign launched a pledge for candidates to take a few weeks ago, and we've had 20 candidates, mostly at the state Senate level, who are challenging either former IDC members or Republicans around the state who are running explicitly on the New York Health Act as their platform for healthcare. So that's very exciting and a very new development to see this take such a central role in the elections. Nationally, we're seeing governor's races all over the country where single payer is becoming a critical central debate between candidates. So there are governors not just in New York, but also in Michigan and Minnesota and California and Iowa and Maryland who are all running on single-payer platforms. We may have a narrative that shows that this has been a huge issue that increases voter turnout, that gets people passionate about getting involved in the elections. And so we may have some exciting outcomes in November.
And I believe one of the candidates running for governor here in New York has already come out in support of the legislation, correct?
Yes. So we know that Cynthia Nixon has spoken favorably of single payer and specifically the New York Health Act recently. And, you know, I should say that Governor Cuomo has said publicly that he thinks single payer is a good idea and, you know, would like to see it at the national level, and basically said we should look more at the numbers on the state level. But yes, it would be great to see that debate continue as we are desperate to create a system that is equitable and humane in healthcare. We really, really need to see the political leadership on this issue.
And Ursula, it's an election year, so candidates are going to be doing town meetings and forums, but there have been a number of cycles of town halls and meetings across the state in recent years, and you helped organize some of them in the upstate part of the of our state. What do everyday people think about this when they hear about it? What are some of the questions they have, et cetera?
Well, regardless ideology, everyone knows someone who has struggled to pay for health care, who's either stayed in a job to keep their insurance, that has skipped needed care. We're conducting a statewide survey, and even though I know the statistics, I'm always shocked to hear that some people put off dental care for decades, for example. So we're hearing that everyone has a story about struggles to access health care. And I think this is really what is going to get us over the finish line to building the movement that we need to guarantee health care in New York. Because the opposition will argue that passing universal health care will cost too much. But we know that already New Yorkers can't afford the health care that they need. And so what we've been finding, especially as we're conducting our statewide health care rights and access survey, is that, people, I would say, do ask, you know, how's this going to work? How's it going to impact my current insurance? But what we're finding is that a lot of people have a lot to get off their chest in terms of the struggles they've gone to in the current system. And so we have a lot of the answers because we know that universal public health care works in other countries. We know that due to things like budget constraints, that's where the challenges come in with public health care systems. But we know that what we have right now just isn't working and that we have a better solution for New York. So, yeah, the way we've been approaching it upstate is to ask people questions about what has their experience been. And it kind of erases that partisan divide that might exist because, like I said, regardless party affiliation, everyone knows someone who struggled with their health, with their health care.
Katie, one of the newer components of the campaign has been the establishment of a People of Color Organizing Committee. Can you fill us in on how that's been going?
Yes, absolutely. So we have a largely volunteer-driven campaign, and several volunteers have stepped up to chair the People of Color Caucus and to really highlight you know, that this is not just an economic justice issue or a health justice issue, but also a racial justice issue, in that people of color, black and brown people, are the ones who suffer the most in the current system, most likely to be uninsured, most likely not to get culturally appropriate care, and the outcomes, the very shameful health outcomes in these, with these demographics, are alarming. You know, we are seeing maternal mortality increase, and black maternal mortality is, you know, greatly more than the risk to a white woman. We need to have a healthcare system that is equitable and has one high standard level of coverage for every single resident, so that we can stop discriminating, basically discriminating against people based on the kind of health insurance that they have. So it's one step in addressing the kind of systemic barriers to care that people of color face. And the People of Color Caucus is working on really reaching out to groups and having those dialogues and creating materials to educate the public on how this issue is also an issue of racial justice.
So the campaign has its big annual Albany Advocacy Day coming up soon, and there may be, in a month or so, another vote, as you indicated, in the state legislature. Ursula, you've organized some of these lobby days in past years. What's it like for people to participate?
Oh, I've been to a couple of different types of lobby days in Albany, and I will say the New York Health Act rally and lobby day is the best one of the legislative session. We're joined by just people from all over the state. The nurses from the New York State Nurses Association, you know, they bring a lot of energy. We have speakers from all walks of life. Business owners, doctors, patients, medical students join us. It's really a diverse gathering of New Yorkers from around the state. And we, you know, we rally, we meet with legislators, and I think everyone walks away more determined to continue organizing in our communities to pass this bill in New York once and for all. But yeah, I can't say enough about our lobby day, because people have told me that, you know, activists that advocate on a variety of issues have told me several times that the New York Health Act Day of Action is the best one of the year.
And Katie, what are the plans specifically for this year?
Sure. Well, there's transportation being organized from all over the state. You know, this truly is a statewide movement, and we should have, you know, we are hoping that we have a bigger turnout than last year, where we brought over 500 New Yorkers to Albany. Essentially, we'll be gathering at 9:30 at the CAP Center in Albany and have a briefing and get into our lobby teams. Then we're going to have a large rally at West Capitol Park from 11:30 to about noon, 12:15. Hopefully we'll get press coverage. There's actually a group of Brooklynites who are planning to ride their bikes from Brooklyn to Albany leading up to the lobby day, leading the Sunday before. And they're doing this to honor a friend of theirs who passed away about a year ago due to lack of health care.
And what's the date on this?
The bike brigade will be leaving Brooklyn on June 3rd, stopping in Peekskill, and then riding into Albany for the rally on June 5th. So if there are people who are interested in joining that or learning more about it, they can be in touch with the Campaign for New York Health. But we're really excited to see this level of creativity and energy going into it. And it's also very meaningful as a symbolic way to honor the people we've lost unnecessarily, being denied health care in the richest country in the world.
So how can people do that? Is there a website, a Facebook page? Yes. How do people get plugged in?
Yes, absolutely. Go to nyhcampaign.org. That's NYH, like New York Health, campaign.org. And you'll see information on signing up for Lobby Day. We encourage you to sign up as soon as possible so we can organize meetings and transportation accordingly. But we really need all hands on deck at this time. It's such a critical time in the movement and in election year. We want this to be an issue that is at the forefront of every New Yorker's thinking in the coming period. So it's really a great time to get on board.
And Ursula, people can also fill out the online survey and share their own personal experience at the website too, correct?
Yeah, it's nyhcampaign.org/tell_your_story.
Great.
So that you can, and it's also, it's linked to from the homepage. Yes.
Great. Well, we've been getting an update on the movement for universal health care in New York and the New York Health Act in particular, a piece of legislation before the state legislature this session. Our guests have been Katie Robbins, who's executive director with the Campaign for New York Health, and Ursula Rossum, who's the upstate coordinator for the campaign. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Katie and Ursula.
Thank you.
Mark. And for all your
Cabriety celebrates Earth Day on Sunday, April 22nd, 1 to 5 p.m. at Generation X Garden. It's open to the public and all ages are invited. For movement, music, and live cultural presentations, that's Generation X Garden, 270 East 4th Street between Avenue B and C. Cabriety, a 501c3 org with a mission to unite people through culture, education, research, and performing arts. The Earth Day celebration on Sunday, April 22nd, 1 to 5 p.m. at Generation X Gardens. For information, call Rosé at 917-995-1191. And good morning. You're listening to Health Action, and this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. WBAI.org. I am Catherine Davis, and I'm live in studio being joined by phone by another person who's live, alive, and live, and awake at this early morning hour here in New York. And I am being joined by John Monroe, who is a natural vision improvement educator. Certainly been a guest on this program and on WBAI in the past. Well, it turns out he's going to be coming to New York, hopefully in May. So we have a chance to bring him on and talk about his work. And since we are live, it may even be possible for you to call if you have some questions. But first, hello and welcome, John.
Hi, Kathy. How are you doing tonight? This morning.
Yeah. Well, for you, it's tonight. For me, it's this morning. It all works out in the end. Yeah, it's good to have you on.
Right.
And for those people who may not remember, you work with the system developed by Dr. Banker, the Natural Vision Improvement system. You have a kit. We have done some fundraising with your material, so people may be very familiar with it, the vision care improvement, the eye charts, and the I think it's a, DVD, a CD, CD that yeah, goes with it and everything.
There's some exercises in there. It's a premium we put together for the fund drive.
Exactly, exactly. Well, today we're not fundraising, but we want right. to let people know. I wanted them to be familiar with your work, for those who may not remember you. But tell us a little something about your workshop that's coming up in May 19th. Well, hopefully, I guess it's
yeah, it's a pre-registration for our workshops because mm-hmm. we have to, you know, travel out to New York to do it. I couldn't just sit there and hope people show up, you know. Mm-hmm. I try to promote these, and they're on our website. They're all listed up there. Mm-hmm. Just click the workshop link, and you'll see them, our upcoming workshops. And the one that we're doing in New York City, we always do it at the Hotel Pennsylvania. And it's right there on 7th Ave and 34th mm-hmm. Street, across the street from Madison Square Garden. And they actually have really nice meeting rooms in that hotel. And this time we're going to use the larger room, the Madison Room. It's a big meeting room, and it can hold up to, you know, we have 24 seats in there. And we seat two people per table. They're 6 feet long, you know, 3 feet wide. So mm-hmm. everybody has plenty of room. Because we're in there for most of the day. You know, our workshop starts at 10 a.m. in the morning, and it's over at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And we take a break for lunch from 1 to 2. Mm-hmm. And usually the workshop can go over a little bit. You know, it might not get over till 5 o'clock, and then people want to order some of our products and things that we bring with us. So
tell us a little something. Will people be doing the eye exercises?
Oh, yeah.
And learning some of the techniques that you talk about?
Oh, yeah. You get one of our vision, you know, the complete self-help vision care kit. That's sitting on the table when you get there. And then we spend the whole day going through it from one end to the other. And we're actually right there to show everybody how to actually do all these exercises. We go through acupressure points, a whole part of the classes on acupressure and mm-hmm. points you can work on, and we go into diet, supplements, herbs, and vitamins. There's a lot of different things we cover at the workshop, and we're right there during the day. It's me and my partner, Jeannie. We mm-hmm. go around and help everybody with it. And it's really good for people that are having trouble reading small print, people that are nearsighted, you know, having trouble seeing far away, people with bifocals, progressive lenses. But it's also good for people that have, you know, different eye problems like macular degeneration, cataracts, you know, having problems with glaucoma, you know, these different type of eye problems, diabetic retinopathy is a big problem people have.
Mm-hmm.
So all types of different eye problems. We also cover things they can do for those. So it's like spending a day with us in the clinic, you know, and we go through everything and work with everybody. Mm-hmm. It's really good when we do one of these. Everybody enjoys it immensely.
And you're actually out in Colorado, right? So you'll be coming into
right.
New York City. So
yeah, we have to fly out. We mm-hmm. fly from Denver to LaGuardia and just, you know, take a taxi over to the Pennsylvania, and mm-hmm. then we check in and we're there.
So for people who want to find out more about this, they can go to drbanker.com, drbanker.com. Or you can call 303-494. What was the last three digits?
4532. So it's 303-494-4532. That's the office number here. And we're on mountain time. You're 2 hours ahead of us. And I'm using the office 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. mountain time here in Boulder.
Okay.
You know, Monday through Saturday. Yeah, you can call here and see what we do and see how we can help you.
All right, well, that's good. You know, and this is something that John Monroe is doing. It's not associated with WBAI directly, but John has done a lot over the years to work with WBAI to help us with our fundraising. And so I think it's only natural for us to let you know. That he that he will be in town, because many, many people have indeed supported those programs. But let's take a step back, John, because a lot of people may not understand what a natural vision improvement educator does, or may not be familiar with Dr. Banker's natural vision improvement system that you work with. So tell us briefly something about Dr. Banker, but more so about yourself, because you yourself are not an MD, but you have been working with the system as trained by Dr. Banker for how many years now?
Well, I started working with Dr. Banker in August 1st, 1993, and I've been working here every day since then. And
okay.
I was trained by her in her approach to improving eye diseases and eye disorders and getting people out of their glasses and improving their eyesight without surgery or drugs. And the workshop, what I'm basically doing is I'm there teaching you how to use her self-help vision care kit. You can see it on our website. You just click the products link and click on the vision improvement kit, and you'll see it, what's in it. And like I said, you can always call us if you have questions. But we run through the whole course. We go through the different eye exercises. We've even had people leave our workshop without their glasses that have low prescriptions, you know, like a plus 1.25 or 1.50 or a minus 1.50. That's the strength of the lenses. And a lot of people, they do see improvement on the eye charts at the workshop, and they're just fascinated by it. They've never really experienced this. And we're right there to show you how to do it.
Okay.
So, that's basically what we do.
Good, good, good. So I'd like to talk about some actual vision issues so that people can have a deeper understanding,
right,
of all that you're speaking of. So let's go into a couple of these eye situations and talk about how they can be improved by this system, the natural vision improvement system. Like you spoke about macular degeneration.
Right.
What are some of the other things that you know, nearsightedness, farsightedness, and
presbyopia. That's trouble reading small print, cataracts, glaucoma. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people have problems with their eyes if they're diabetic, you know, diabetic retinopathy. But we also work on how to improve diabetes, high blood pressure, weight loss, how to, you know, get more energy and stamina through diet and supplements and herbs and different products. And I'm even working with stem cell activators now we're trying on people. So we have a whole lot of things that you can learn about. And we do this through research and study with patients and people we've worked with that try things out. So we actually do studies on different supplements and herbs and products.
So give us a little bit of information so that people who are listening will have something, you know, to take with them in terms of what they can do for themselves or to understand these conditions. People get interested based on what you share. That's how they make their decisions about, you know, moving further.
Right.
So tell us about how some of these exercises or vitamins or some of the things that you work with, and, you know, give us some idea of how it can help improve a person's vision.
Well, when people are nearsighted or farsighted, they're having trouble with the six outer eye muscles that move the eye up and down, left and right, any direction you can move it. And we address these muscles. There's diagrams in our manual and the kit that show you the different parts of the eye, the muscles, everything you'll be working on. And then also when you have trouble reading presbyopia, reading small print, that's trouble with the ciliary body. It's a muscle that goes around the lens inside of the eye. It's behind the iris, the color part of the eye. And that lens has a muscle all the way around it. It's like a sphincter muscle. It's kind of like a rubber band. And when you try to read small print, your brain notices that. It sends a signal to the muscle. It tightens up and squeezes the lens, and the lens bulges out and gets thicker. And when the muscle loosens up, the lens will get thinner. And it's an actual focusing mechanism that you have inside of your eye. Most people don't even know it exists, you know, and we explain how this works. And the reading vision comes back pretty quickly because it's one small muscle you're working on. The near and far sightedness takes a little more time. And but we also explain how you can get cataracts and glaucoma from using reading glasses, bifocals, trifocals, progressive lenses after 10 years of use, and how you can have floaters develop and retinal detachments if you become too nearsighted or farsighted. So there are problems that develop over time when you use glasses, you know, all day long. You're wearing these glasses all the time, and as you need stronger and stronger prescriptions in your glasses, that means your nearsightedness, your farsightedness, your presbyopia is getting worse. And that's why they have to give you a stronger lens. So we even work with people that have had LASIK surgery, and then a year or two later, their vision becomes blurry again because their nearsightedness got worse, and it's changed their vision in their eye. So we can even bring that back. If people have had LASIK surgery, and then a couple years later, they notice their vision getting worse again.
And how do you bring it back, John?
Through the eye exercises. We're releasing the tension in these muscles. They tighten up and hold tension. The outer eye muscles do that, and they can actually squeeze the eye and make it more elongated. Mm-hmm. And then the ciliary body in the eye that you read with, which is around the lens, that muscle can toughen up and you know, tighten up from staring too much at what you're reading and how you read. So there's a lot of information on this, and it's a great workshop if we can get people to go to it.
Well, perhaps we have about, looks like about 10 minutes in this segment. If any of you do have questions about natural vision improvement, you can call 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. So tell us about some of the nutritional influences on natural vision improvement, or some of these new substances. I suppose they're considered nutrient and supplements, and how they interact with the body. So give us an idea of what is...
Well, your diet and lifestyle, attitude, we address all this. Your environment,
John,
how you're
John,
feeling.
John, yeah. I want you to address it here on the air. You know, if you could share something now is what we need to do
so that
people could understand what you're talking about.
Well, when I talk about diet, I'm talking about, you know, the good foods to eat for your eyes and your body, the bad foods that you're eating that cause problems, free radicals, toxins, chemicals in foods, GMOs, different refined oils, processed meats, you know, the things that are causing a lot of these problems, high blood pressure, coffee, you know, that's a big problem with the tannic acid that causes your blood vessels to tighten up. So we go way into diet and supplements, you know, vitamins. Vitamin C is real good for the eye, electrolytes, vitamin D3, lutein. There's a lot of different nutrients that are real nutritional value for the retina, the inner lining of the eye. Also, cleaning out the blood vessels in the eye or your body and increasing blood flow to the cells helps to improve disorders. I mean, we've gotten people off of coffee and caffeine and sugar and other things that they're doing.
Okay.
And their macular degeneration is improved.
Hold on just a second. We may have a call. Hello,
right.
You're on the air. Do you have a question?
Good evening. Yes, I do have a question.
Yes, go ahead, please.
There's something on your eye called floaters.
Right.
And it blocks, I think it's on top of the cornea. And it blocks certain parts of the vision wherever these floaters are. Sometimes they're pretty big.
I can address that for you.
What's the best way of breaking them up?
Well, floaters, first thing, it's good to know what a floater actually is. And the retina is the inner lining of the eye. It's the thickness of tissue paper. And then on top of the retina, there's a thin coating vitreous jelly, it's called. And it's kind of like Vaseline. And then the rest of the eye is full of aqueous humor. It's kind of like egg white. And what you're noticing with a floater, it's when some of that vitreous jelly breaks loose and it's floating around in the fluid in the eye and the aqueous humor. And you'll see maybe a little black hair, a little dot, or they can be even larger, you know. And some of them can be like kind of a brown color. Some of them are black. And that's a floater. And a lot of times it's from the eye being too dehydrated and the jelly dries up and can break loose. We also notice that people are very nearsighted. The eye is more egg-shaped, and it's pulling on the retina, and the vitreous jelly can break loose and float around the eye. So there are things you can do to help reattach the floaters. You want to reattach that loose vitreous jelly back to the vitreous jelly on the retina, and you want to learn what's causing them to float around. Alcohol is a big contributor to floaters because it dehydrates the eye. Cigarettes and the smoke and chemicals that are in the cigarettes, coffee and tea, even your environment, you know, the air around you, you know, that can affect the eye. So there's things that cause floaters to happen, and there is ways to improve that condition.
So, John, why don't you share one of these ways to improve the condition?
Well, one way is, you know, when you drink alcohol and the next morning you get up, you're real dehydrated and you have to drink water. Well, you know, it's a real problem with dehydrating the eye. And then blood circulation to the eye affects the retina and the condition of the retina, and then the jelly can come loose. And vitreous jelly forms when you're born, and it's on the retina, and it helps the eye nutritionally as it's developing in the womb and as you're growing. And then after you're about 3 or 4 years old, you don't really even use it. It just sits there on the eye. So there's a lot, you know, a lot of information that you can learn about at the workshop on this.
John, please share something that will allow people to know what they can do to improve it.
Well, one thing is to curb your alcohol and cigarettes. Another thing is hydrating the body more, drinking more fluids through the day. Water, juices, natural organic teas help. A good drink that you can make is aloe vera juice with papaya, guava, mango, and peach. And you put all that in a blender and blend it up and drink it about 16 ounces a day. If you're having a lot of problems with floaters, and that can help to relieve the problem. It helps hydrate the eye. It makes the vitreous jelly more sticky, so the little particles floating around in the eye can reattach to the retina. So that's a real good drink, the aloe vera with papaya, guava, peach, and mango. That's all your sticky fruits. And you blend that up and drink it. And, you know, green tea, all your teas, blueberry tea, peppermint tea opens up the blood vessels. There's a lot of these organic teas that are real good.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, caller.
And if you have any questions, you can always call me at the office Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mountain Time. And I'm right here to help you out.
Okay, and that number is 303-494-4532. So that's cool. And so that's good. So I don't think we have any more calls coming in or really time to take those calls. But, maybe you can give one more tip, John, before we take off. You know, you have a full day to share information, but it's really important to share something that people can really use as part of the radio as well.
Well, the big problem with the macular degeneration, wet or dry, it's a problem with the blood flow to the retina in most cases. It can also be from too much exposure to sunlight, UV rays, or, you know, infrared rays from the sun. And but coffee is really, you know, decaffeinated or not, the tannic acid and the caffeine, when you drink that, it can increase your blood pressure because it causes the blood vessels to tighten up and constrict. And the blood vessels in the retina in your eye are the size of a human hair, and they can tighten up real easily and cut off blood flow. And refined oils can clog up the blood vessels, you know, plaque and calcium. So you really want to work on blood flow to the retina to help improve macular degeneration and stop the progression of it. Wearing sunglasses when you're outside with a black lens that's UV protected and it's polarized, and you know, you want to use a wraparound frame. Sunglasses are important to help protect the lens in the eye and the retina in the eye. So there's a lot of great things you can do for your eyes if you work at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important for people to know.
That's the whole workshop's about, empowering yourself and learning how to do this and actually going and seeing what this is. I mean, I'm right there showing you how this works. And
okay, well, that's very good. Thank you so much, John. We really appreciate all that you offer for people.
Oh, there's
who are
tons
making
of stuff.
These transitional, you know, making these choices to be self-empowered,
right,
and to be able to heal themselves. So you can find out more at drbanker.com, or you can call 303-494-4532. Okay, thanks.
All right, Kathy, I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Celebrate Earth Day at Planet Heart's 11th Annual World Peace Earth Day Celebration, celebrating our planet, healing our heart. A conscious, spiritual community gathering in unity with special presenters that will honor our Earth and New Earth with inspirational talks, live music performances, and ceremony. That's Saturday, April 21st from 6:30 p.m. sharp till 9:45 p.m. at the New York New Church at 114 East 35th Street in New York City. Doors open at 6 p.m. For tickets and information, go to planetheart.org or call 212-222-5432.
I
Chiquete, hoje um bem achado.
Sitzitlalte Ujundu. Shikitlalte Ujundu. Altsmute Ujumpina Shado. Ujum Beden Stedo. Ujum. Nashado Lil. Ujum Hustling. Ujum Hustling. Ujum Hustling. Ujum Hustling.
Встречался с тобой, потерял я покой. В сердце боль и тоска, от любви стал не свой. Ну приди же скорей, стань навеки моей. Я хочу быть с тобой и найду я покой. Пролетели года, но не встретил тебя. В моем сердце костер не угас до сих пор. Я мечтаю о том и уверен в одном.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, writer, editor, poet, publisher, bon vivant, Gordon Linsner. If you want to watch, go to my timeline on Facebook Live. If you want to listen, already there.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. My job is to think about how films get made, how they succeed and fail at what they're trying to do. That's why I get paid the big bucks. Ahem. That's not your job. As audience member, you need do nothing more than sit back, let the film wash over you, and hopefully enjoy the experience. And then, afterwards, you listen to my review, or you think back on what I said if you heard the review before seeing the film, and you go, huh, that gives me a whole new perspective on what I've seen. Or you go, Dan's full of manure. That's fair as well, as long as it gets you thinking more fully about what you experienced and how you feel about it. My job is done then. In the new Wes Anderson stop-motion animated film Isle of Dogs, in which all the dogs of a large Japanese metropolis, who talk in this film with the voices of, among others, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Scarlett Johansson, and Harvey Keitel, are exiled to a quote-unquote garbage island, and a young boy ventures to that island to search for his beloved pet, there are moments when characters will turn to look into the camera. This happens a lot. Sometimes this is styled as typical behavior, a dog being briefly distracted by some noise or other stimulus. Just as frequently, it's done as an overt breaking of the fourth wall. The effect is the same in either case. The audience becomes aware of the presence of the camera, the nature of film. In one sequence, we watch as an elaborate meal of sushi is prepared. The various raw and somewhat dismaying ingredients, a whole fish and octopus tentacle, being transformed into beautiful, abstract shapes. The sequence calls attention to the natural being transformed into art, the process further abstracted by the nature of stop-motion animation. I don't think this is by accident. I think Anderson is deliberately calling attention to his process. It's been there in his live-action films, all those self-conscious, symmetrically arranged tableaus, the lateral tracking shots, the formality of the acting, and it's doubly, maybe trebly so, in his animated films, where everything can be stylized and stage-managed to the nth degree. I had been puzzling over why the film is set in Japan until I landed on the blatantly obvious fact that Japanese culture is grounded on a formalized stylization, from kabuki to manga to anime. If it was just stylization, it would be annoying. We have no shortage of films that are ravishing to behold, but that then think that that's all that's needed. Anderson's gift is to make us care about the characters moving within these formalized environments, particularly children. And the kids of Isle of Dogs, similar to kids in other Anderson films, carry themselves with an unchildlike dignity, but also harbor the intensity and sincerity that's only found in those who have yet to be overwhelmed by the demands of adulthood. There's a refreshing lack of irony in how these characters are portrayed. The boy, Atari, voiced by Koyu Rankin, speaks in untranslated, unsubtitled Japanese, yet we understand implicitly the earnestness of his words. A crusading adolescent journalist whose head is framed with an epic halo of frizzy hair, voiced by Greta Gerwig, storms through the story with a bracing intensity typical of Anderson's younger female characters. Wes Anderson's overt artificiality frequently trips me up. There's a part of me that struggles against a style that so blatantly calls attention to itself. But I can't argue that I don't enjoy the look and the outlook of his films, or regret the trips he takes us on. Isle of Dogs is beautiful to behold, quirky in its conceits, and just a wonderful experience. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And let me, first of all, thank you, Dan. And let me add to that that I am not like a number one Wes Anderson fanatic. There are those people that anything Wes Anderson has done is fabulous. And when I went to see that movie actually, from where we are, the local cinema, it's about five blocks from here, right near Junior's. They had a whole short subject on Wes Anderson, and you could see just how fanatical they were about his films. And the first one I saw was The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is also stop-motion animation. It's worth noting that Isle of Dogs is his second animated film. And I loved it. It was very different. I'm a big fan of stop motion. And then I saw Moonrise Kingdom, and I began only two films in. And you could already see, yes, this guy has a style, that there was actually a great deal of similarity between this guy's live action and stop motion. So, yes, there is such a thing. Then, I don't remember which film it was. It might have been the Steve Zissou movie. I can say it's one with Bill Murray in it, but you see, Wes Anderson has never made a movie without Bill Murray. So, yeah, that doesn't really pin it down a great deal. So suffice it to say that, I saw Moonrise Kingdom and I loved it. It's the same kind of film in its way as Isle of Dogs. And even though it's live action, it's every bit as artificial in its way and delightful. But, so let me just say that while Isle of Dogs is still... Oh, here's an important point. See Isle of Dogs on a big screen. I'm guessing Dan did not. There are so many what they like to call Easter eggs in the film because the dogs are all living on this isle, which is, by the way, in the shape of a hand. You start at the... at the wrist, you go to the knuckles, and the end of the island, the place that they're trying to reach in their quest, is the cuticle, and which is a very cuticle way of looking. And the what point was I going to make about that? Yes. There's garbage everywhere. So if you look carefully, you will see things that Wally discarded. So there's a lot of that kind of little winks and tips, including his own films, but including a lot of other films that Anderson enjoys, and he is a film fanatic. So for that reason, I really do recommend big screen, because otherwise you're going to have to do the stop motion thing when the Blu-ray comes out, and it may not work for you. Before we get to show proper, announcements time. May Day, by which I mean May 1st. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, our next one. We were originally going to be doing a tribute of sorts, but the people tributing are not able to make it to New York. So we have switched courses, and we are instead presenting people that, well, are totally, equally worthy. And, I see I should have written this down. I haven't even gotten the web page up yet to announce it. But Ilana C. Meyer, whose new book from Tor has been getting rave notices in places where they choose to notice various science fiction works, and getting accolades everywhere. This is her second novel, first one in 5 years. She will be one of our two readers. And the other is a Canadian writer, poet, critic, and all kinds of stuff, Jo Walton. That's J-O. This is a woman. And she is brilliant and wonderful. Starlings, I think, was her latest work. She writes reviews for...